and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from The Atlantic, from The Christian Post, from Quartz.com, and more. This week's broadcast is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. We thank them for their contribution. The content of this broadcast is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from The Atlantic published on September 26th. I just came across it recently and thought it would be worth sharing. The article is titled, Three Decades Ago, America Lost Its Religion. Why? And the subheadline, Not Religious Has Become a Specific American Identity, one that distinguishes secular liberal whites from the conservative evangelical right. And this is by Derek Thompson of the Atlantic. The idea of American exceptionalism has become so dubious that much of its modern usage is merely sarcastic. But when it comes to religion, Americans really are exceptional. No rich country prays nearly as much as the U.S., and no country that prays as much as the U.S. is nearly as rich. America's unique synthesis of wealth and worship has puzzled international observers and foiled their grandest theories of a global secular takeover. In the late 19th century, an array of celebrity philosophers, the likes of Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, and Sigmund Freud, proclaimed the death of God and predicted that atheism would follow scientific discovery and modernity in the West, sure as smoke follows fire. Stubbornly pious Americans threw a wrench in the secularization thesis. Deep into the 20th century, more than 9 in 10 Americans said they believed in God and belonged to an organized religion, with the great majority of them calling themselves Christian. That number held steady through the sexual revolution 60s, through the rootless and anxious 70s, and through the greed is good 80s. But in the early 1990s, the historical tether between American identity and faith snapped. Religious non-affiliation in the U.S. started to rise, and rise, and rise. By the early 2000s, the share of Americans who said they didn't associate with any established religion, in parentheses also known as nuns, had doubled. By the 2010s, this grab bag of atheists, agnostics, and spiritual dabblers had tripled in size. History does not often give the satisfaction of a sudden and lasting turning point. History tends to unfold in messy cycles, actions and reactions, revolutions and counter-revolutions, and even semi-permanent changes are subtle and glacial. But the rise of religious non-affiliation in America looks like one of those rare historical moments that is neither slow, nor subtle, nor cynical. You might call it exceptional. The obvious question for anybody who spends at least 2 seconds looking at a graph is, what the hell happened around 1990? According to Christian Smith, a sociology and religion professor at the University of Notre Dame, America's non-religious lurch has mostly been the result of three historical events: the association of the Republican Party with the Christian right, the end of the Cold War, and 9/11. This story begins with the rise of the religious right in the 1970s. Alarmed by the spread of secular culture, including but not limited to the sexual revolution, the Roe v. Wade decision, the nationalization of no-fault divorce laws, and Bob Jones University losing its tax-exempt status over its ban on interracial dating, Christians became more politically active. The GOP welcomed them with open arms. The party, which was becoming more dependent on its exurban white base, needed a grassroots strategy and a policy platform. Within the next decade, the religious right, including Ralph Reed's Christian Coalition, James Dobson's Focus on the Family, and Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority, had become fundraising and organizing juggernauts for the Republican Party. In 1980, the GOP social platform was a facsimile of conservative Christian views on sexuality, abortion, and school prayer. The marriage between the religious and political right delivered Reagan, Bush, and countless state and local victories. But it disgusted liberal Democrats, especially those with weak connections to the church. It also shocked the conscience of moderates, who preferred a wide berth between their faith and their politics. Smith said it's possible that young liberals and loosely affiliated Christians first registered their aversion to the Christian right in the early 1990s, after a decade of observing its powerful role in conservative politics. Second, it may have felt unpatriotic to confess one's ambivalence toward God while the U.S. was locked in a geopolitical showdown with a godless evil empire. In 1991, however, the Cold War ended. As the USSR dissolved, so did atheism's association with America's nemesis. After that, nuns could be forthright about their religious indifference without worrying that it made them sound like Soviet apologists. Third, America's next geopolitical foe wasn't a godless state. It was a God-fearing, stateless movement, radical Islamic terrorism. A series of bombings and attempted bombings in the 1990s by fundamentalist organizations such as Al-Qaeda culminated in the 9/11 attacks. It would be a terrible oversimplification to suggest that the fall of the Twin Towers encouraged millions to leave their church, Smith said. But over time, Al-Qaeda became a useful referent for atheists who wanted to argue that all religions were necessarily destructive. Meanwhile, during George W. Bush's presidency, Christianity's association with unpopular Republican policies drove more young liberals and moderates away from both the party and the church. New atheists, such as Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, became intellectual celebrities. The 2006 bestseller American Theocracy argued that evangelicals in the Republican Party coalition were staging a quiet coup that would plunge the country into disarray and financial ruin. Throughout the Bush presidency, liberal voters, especially white liberal voters, detached from organized religion in ever higher numbers. Religion has lost its halo effect in the past three decades, not because science drove God from the public square, but rather because politics did. In the 21st century, not religious has become a specific American identity, one that distinguishes secular liberal whites from the conservative evangelical right. Other social forces, which have little to do with geopolitics or partisanship, have played a key role in the rise of the nuns. The church is just one of many social institutions, including banks, Congress, and the police, that have lost public trust in an age of elite failure. But scandals in the Catholic Church have accelerated its particularly rapid loss of moral stature. According to Pew Research, 13% of Americans today self-identify as former Catholics, and many of them leave organized religion altogether. And as the ranks of the nuns have swelled, it's become more socially acceptable for casual or rare churchgoers to tell pollsters that they don't particularly identify with any faith. It's also become easier for nuns to meet, marry, and raise children who grew up without any real religious attachment. Nor does Smith rule out the familiar antagonists of capitalism and the Internet in explaining the popularity of non-affiliation. The former has made life more precarious, and the latter has made it easier for anxious individuals to build their own spiritualities from ideas and practices they find online, he said, such as Buddhist meditation guides and atheist Reddit boards. Most important has been the dramatic changes in the American family. The past half century has dealt a series of body blows to the American marriage. Divorce rates spiked in the 70s through the 90s, following the state-by-state spread of no-fault divorce laws. Just as divorce rates stabilized, the marriage rate started to plummet in the 80s due to both the decline of marriage within the working class and delayed marriage among college-educated couples. There's historically been this package: get married, go to church or temple, have kids, send them to Sunday school, Smith said. But just as stable families make stable congregations, family instability can destabilize the church. Divorced individuals, single parents, and children of divorce or single-parent households are all more likely to detach over time from their congregations. Finally, the phenomenon of delayed adulthood might be another subtle contributor. More Americans, especially college graduates in big metro areas, are putting off marriage and childbearing until their 30s and are using their 20s to establish a career, date around, and enjoy being young and single in a city. By the time they settle down, they've established a routine: work, brunch, gym, date, drink, football, that leaves little room for daily mass. They know who they are by 30, and they don't feel like they need a church to tell them, Smith said. The rise of the nuns shows no signs of slowing down. In fact, the religious identity that seems to be doing the best job at both retaining old members and attracting new ones is the newfangled American religion of nothing much at all. Does the rise of the nuns matter? Let's first consider the possibility that it doesn't. As America's youth have slipped away from organized religion, they haven't quite fallen into wickedness. If today's young people are uniquely conscientious, less likely to fight, drink, use hard drugs, or have premarital sex than previous generations. They might not be able to quote from the Book of Matthew, but their economic and social politics, which insist on protections for the politically meek and the historically persecuted, aren't so far from a certain reading of the Beatitudes. But the liberal politics of young people brings us to the first big reason to care about rising non-affiliation. A gap has opened up between America's two political parties. In a twist of fate, the Christian right entered politics to save religion, only to make the Christian-Republican nexus unacceptable to millions of young people, thus accelerating the country's turn against religion. Although it would be wrong to call Democrats a secular party, in parentheses, older black voters are highly religious and dependably vote Democratic, the left today has a higher share of religiously unaffiliated voters than any time in modern history. At the same time, the average religiosity of white Christian Republicans has gone up, according to Robert P. Jones, the CEO of the polling firm PRRI and the author of The End of White Christian America. Evangelicals feel so embattled that they've turned to a deeply immoral and authoritarian champion to protect them, even if it means rendering unto an American Caesar whatever the hell he wants. American politics is at risk of becoming a war of religiosity versus secularism by proxy, where both sides see the other as a catastrophic political force that must be destroyed at all costs. The deeper question is whether the sudden loss of religion has social consequences for Americans who opt out. Secular Americans, who are familiar with the ways the traditional faiths have betrayed modern liberalism, may not have examined how organized religion has historically offered solutions to their modern existential anxieties. Making friends as an adult without a weekly congregation is hard. Establishing a weekend routine to soothe Sunday afternoon nerves is hard. Reconciling the overwhelming sense of life's importance with the universe's ostensible indifference to human suffering is hard. Although belief in God is no panacea for these problems, religion is more than a theism. It is a bundle, a theory of the world, a community, a social identity, a means of finding peace and purpose, and a weekly routine. Those like me who have largely rejected this package deal often find themselves shopping a la carte for meaning, community, and routine to fill a faith-shaped void. Their politics is a religion. Their work is a religion. Their spin class is a church. And not looking at their phone for several consecutive hours is a Sabbath. American nuns may well build successful secular systems of belief, purpose, and community. But imagine what a devout believer might think. Millions of Americans have abandoned religion, only to recreate it everywhere they look. Next up on Religion in the News this week is an article that was published in a few different places. I'm going to read from Quartz.com. The headline, Technology-Oriented Religions Are Coming. And this article is by Stan Stalnaker, who is listed as the founding director of Hub Culture Group. And this was published on Quartz.com on October 9th. This article begins with a quotation from something referred to as the neo-secularia. In the beginning, technologists created the science fiction. Now the fiction was formless and empty, and the darkness lay over the surface of the science, and the spirit of mathematics hovered over their creation. And the technologists said, "Let there be internet," and there was connection. Technologists called the internet community, and the science they called progress. And there was community, and there was progress, the first day. Religious ideas and powerful radical theologies pepper our science fiction. From Klingon religions in Star Trek to the Bene Gesserit in the Dune series, Cylon in Battlestar Galactica to the pervasive caveism in Kurt Vonnegut's works, our society has little trouble imagining the concept of new religions. We just don't implement them. Modern society has been unsuccessful in scaling new religions beyond the cults of personality or the niches of Scientology. But as the digital and virtual worlds evolve, this is set to change. The 21st century is setting the stage for a new type of widespread faith, technology-based religions. Technology today is pervasive and granulated. It encompasses our worldview, and people are translating it into their spiritual views. The internet acts as an accelerant on these forces, enabling cross-pollination and mutation at rapid rates. This slippery slope of transmutation provides new guardrails for how technology itself can become a new cult or religion, or at least a component of them. Techno-oriented religious movements represent a big departure from the strategies of 20th century-style cults, which could make them even more dangerous. The foundations for this growth are governed by three factors: the Internet, which allows for rapid scale, quantified self-technologies, which promise self-betterment, and new surveillance methods, which ensure a whole new type of peer-pressured submission. Today's major religions, including Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism, took hundreds of years to propagate. Their turning points from small factions to true movements happened when they addressed social injustices. The paganisms of the Romans was one thing, but it was their injustices to the people of Judea that gave ground for the rise of Judaism and later Christianity. In 1517, the sale of Roman Catholic indulgences sparked Luther's 95 Theses on Power and Efficacy of Indulgences, kicking off the Protestant movement and revolting against perceived corruption by the Church. Tech-backed movements like the Arab Spring, Black Lives Matter, and hashtag Climate Strike scaled by tapping into a growing sense of social injustice. Right or left, economic inequality is becoming visible on a global scale, and technology is connecting all of those audiences into one digital network tasked to effect change. Instead of legal or economic changes, these movements rely on social agreement as their first outcome. Social agreement is powerful and represents a type of groupthink that can evolve quickly into action when it reaches a tipping point. Today we have the ability to scale audiences to extremes and have instant access to whatever Reddit or Facebook group will best serve a message. No more wandering the plains of medieval Europe seeking people to convert. Social media has brought billions of people right to you from the safety of your couch. There's a huge audience of lonely people looking for spiritual answers to social injustice. A 2018 Cigna report indicated 47% of Americans feel lonely sometimes or always, while a PRRI 2017 study further showed that 18% of Americans are spiritual but not religious, and 69% are some combination of the two. And it's not just in America. 84% of the global population identifies as religious, according to Pew Research Center, which makes it relevant globally from Beijing to Lagos to Ohio. The Internet has made social injustice more visible, movements easier to start, and causes easier to join. While tech-led social movements are not yet religious movements, they lay the groundwork for mutated spiritual movements to copy similar values and conditions to gain scale. Over the last several years, mindfulness, defined as paying attention to our thoughts and feelings without judging them, has exploded into popular consciousness. It's a part of a wellness movement focused on inward explanation, breath work, yoga, and meditation that has brought people tools of personal growth and empowerment. The next phase of this obsession with self-betterment is augmented mindfulness. Quantified self devices track all manner of biological and mental functions in the form of everything from electrocardiograms on the latest smartwatches or brainwave scanners like Emotive, promising to one day map emotions. To take it one step further again, neural interfaces such as Neuralink, Elon Musk's project, promise mind-reading threads embedded in your brain that connect your emotions to the computer. Likewise, Facebook is building algorithms to decode brain activity into words that can be processed in real time. We're only one big jump from a computer being able to outright read your thoughts. Traditional religions have connected humanity to feelings of unity and higher purpose. Augmented mindfulness is set to upend our perceptions of the boundaries between ourselves and our purpose, virtual or real. But can technology process God into something we can finally understand? The results are most evident in the upper echelons of technology's inner circles, where blockchain builders, yogic shapeshifters, and Burning Man believers turn into transhumanist experimenters actively discussing this question. If only enough computing power is thrown at the equation, the thinking goes, we'll ultimately connect the dots. In parentheses, some people theorize that reality looks like a post-chaotic 248 vertice lattice structure called an E8. That's a rabbit hole you'll have to Google. The third component is related to AI and its insatiable need for large amounts of data, which coincides nicely with the work of governments around the world installing pervasive surveillance systems in the fight against terror, speeding, or human freedom, depending on your domicile. Whether it is the growing pressure of the Chinese social credit system, the parsing of billions of consumer mobile conversations by the NSA, or the elimination of cash in favor of digital wallets and identities across India, the data explosion has morphed into a shared permanent record, in parentheses, as so well articulated in Edward Snowden's book of the same name. Peer surveillance and groupthink is a hallmark of religious pressure, especially in cults where the enforcement of principles handed down by the leadership is performed by the crowd. Setting these norms and enforcing them in this emerging world becomes the responsibility not of individual peers, but by the algorithmic decisions of vast data inputs from the crowd. The outline of this alpha network is taking shape, with monolithic corporate tech control in the West, a party-controlled AI network in China, and even plans for a pan-Islamic AI system, announced by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman at his annual investment conference in 2018. All of these systems seek to process the large data sets of aggregated surveillance, benign or otherwise, in order to provide shared intelligence about their respective societies, and will eventually be applied in wider circles among differing actors until it's inescapable. Together, these trends point the way to fertile ground for digital cults and religions in methods and ways foreign to our past. Is Greta Thunberg's climate revolution the beginning of a movement and a new ecological mandate? Are the neo-Nazi far right seeking a spiritual home for deep rhetoric? And most importantly, how will any of us resist the temptation to just follow along when everyone else in your social network has joined whatever the Fortnite, WhatsApp, TikTok mashup of all that becomes? We feel pressured into joining whatever new social media platform is du jour, or downloading whatever buzzy app everyone else is using. What happens when these forces coalesce into social movements that demand more from us? The technological tools are there, and so is the social pressure to enlist, as well as our lack of individual ability to resist. At some level, everything is about control. It is worth being wary of how these technologies are being used, who is advocating for them, and who owns them, to make sure their evolution is in our best interest. Religion can be a wonderful and inclusive tool pushing society forward, but the line between the freedom to pursue religion and the pressure to conform to new ones should be carefully guarded. Our next article this week on religion in the news comes from the Christian Post. It was published on Wednesday, October 9th, and the headline, Religion, a Regular Part of the Public School Day for U.S. Teens, Pew Study Finds. And this is by Leah Marie Ann Klett, a Christian Post reporter. While religion in schools is a contentious subject in the courts, a new Pew study has found that for many of today's teenagers, public expressions of religion are a normal and accepted part of their public school experience. In a study released on October 3rd, Pew surveyed five types of religious expressions and activities: wearing religious clothing or jewelry, praying before a sporting event, inviting other students to youth groups or services, praying before eating lunch, and reading religious scripture during the school day. According to the study, 67% of teenagers said they see at least some sort of religious expression at a public school on a regular basis. Overall, 53% of students often or sometimes see students wearing clothing or jewelry with religious symbols, and 39% of students often or sometimes have seen peers pray before a school sport event, Pew said. Showing slightly less participation, about 26% of students have seen peers praying before eating lunch, and 8% have seen students reading religious scriptures outside of class, Pew said. While several previous surveys have examined the religious lives of teenagers, Pew said in a press release, this is the first large-scale, nationally representative survey asking teens a series of questions about their own practices and perceptions regarding religious expressions in public schools. The survey is important to the broader study of religion in American society, Pew said, because of the friendships adolescents form in their classes and the way they experience religion in public spaces during some of their most formative years. Among religiously affiliated teenagers, evangelical Protestants were the most likely to pray at lunch or invite others to a church event. In total, 39% say they often or sometimes prayed before they ate, while 43% say they'd invited friends to a youth group activity or similar religious event. But in comparison, just 11% of mainline Protestant teens say they pray before they eat at school, and just 21% have invited friends to a church event. Additionally, while most American teens, 64%, say they rarely or never discuss religion with their friends, evangelical Protestants are much more likely than others to engage in this type of religious behavior. Roughly 6 in 10 evangelical teens say they sometimes, 47%, or often, 11%, talk to their friends about religion, compared with 4 in 10 mainline Protestant teens, a third of Catholics, and about 1 in 5 religious nuns. Interestingly, Pew also found that teenagers with no religious affiliation are far less likely than their religious peers to notice public displays of religion at school. Just 17% of atheist, agnostic, or religiously unaffiliated teens say they sometimes or often see people invited to religious activities outside of school, compared to nearly twice the amount of Christian teens who say the same. The study was conducted in March and April of about 1,800 13 to 17-year-olds. Pew included students from many religious backgrounds, including Christian and non-Christian faiths. Controversies regarding religion in schools have continued to arise in U.S. high schools in recent months. In September, a Middle Tennessee school district came under fire after an atheist group lodged a formal complaint accusing educators of violating the U.S. Constitution when they allowed two student athletes to be baptized on the school's football field in front of teammates. Also in September, the Young Life National Christian Group was denied recognition as an official student group at North Carolina's Duke University because it bars members of the LGBT community from holding leadership posts. In January, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal from high school coach Joe Kennedy in Washington State, who was fired for praying repeatedly on the football field. Where exactly to draw the line between constitutionally protected religious activity and impermissible state-sponsored indoctrination remains under dispute, Pew said. We'll wrap up this week's edition of Religion in the News with an article from Religion News Service from October 10th. The headline, Yom Kippur Shooting in Germany, Latest Indication of Increasing Anti-Semitism. This is from the Associated Press, and we'll edit this for time. The shooting that left two dead and several injured in Halle, Germany on Wednesday, October 9th, when Jews celebrated Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year for their faith, has shined a spotlight on the worldwide rise of anti-Semitic incidents. The attack in Germany, where investigators are pursuing anti-Semitic motives after the assailant reportedly shot at the door of the synagogue in an attempt to gain entry, drew swift condemnation from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres and renewed calls from Jewish groups in the U.S. to step up cooperation in combating anti-Semitism. We've been saying for several years that anti-Semitism is real, it's resurgent, it's lethal, and it's multi-sourced, American Jewish Committee CEO David Harris said in an interview. Harris added that the attack in Halle, coming near the one-year anniversary of an anti-Semitic shooting that killed 11 worshippers at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue, should all be triggering alarm bells. The question is whether they are. Robert Bank, president and CEO of American Jewish World Service, issued a statement calling on people of every background around the world to combat the increasing waves of hatred and intolerance against all people, including anti-Semitic, racist, Islamophobic, misogynistic, homophobic, and transphobic violence. The Anti-Defamation League, which called the Germany shooting heartbreaking in a Wednesday statement, reported earlier this year that violent anti-Semitic episodes in the United States doubled in 2018. In Canada, the government reported a 4% dip in anti-Semitic attacks last year, but only after a sharp rise in 2017. Well, we've reached the end of this week's edition of Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.